that comic pages as a highly popular section of the daily press solidified during the 1910s and 1920s. At first, the strips were miniature versions of the Sunday funnies in gag format and appearing no more than three times per week. In 1912, Hearst introduced the first daily page of comics in his New York Evening Journal. Four strips daily eventually became nine strips daily. Other newspapers followed suit, and newspaper syndicates quickly assumed control of most strips, distributing them for the artist and collecting most of the money in the process. It was, as more than one critic has suggested, the television of the 1910s to 1940s, every bit as popular as contemporary radio, with no layout of cash for hardware among the often impoverished readers.
In our rush to get through the morning paper, we might glance at a few favorite funnies on the comics page. But once upon a time, comics were a priority for many Americans, and more than a few panels of important comics history took shape right here in Wisconsin. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How did the comics develop into such a national phenomenon, and what did they have to say about life in America? How did underground comics develop, and are they still with us? To what extent are comics art? And with communication technology changing almost daily, what's likely to be the future of the comics? Our guest is Paul Buell, who has published more than 40 volumes on popular culture. He's a distinguished lecturer for the American Studies Association and the Organization for American History. His most recent book is Comics in Wisconsin, published by Borderland Books in 2009 and distributed by the UW Press.
Oh, welcome to University of the Year.
Thanks very much.
It might seem obvious, but maybe we could start with a definition of comics. In other words, does it have to be a series of pictures as opposed to just one cartoon panel?
This is one of the most confusing notions within the creation of comic art today because none of the words seem quite right. The word comics immediately suggests humor, whereas there are many comic strips and graphic novels that aren't humorous at all. The recent phrase graphic novels suggests fiction, whereas much of the best work is nonfiction. Some artists, I think of one, Ben Ketchor, a MacArthur Award winner, who wishes the phraseology would be sequential art, but I have no hopes for that phrase. It's almost as bad as cartoons, which historically could mean either the 10-minute movies between feature films, animated films in their most original and originally popular form, or it could be the political cartoon in the daily newspaper. So we're a little unable to pin down what comics are. But in a very general sense, comics have come to mean comic art, and they've also come to mean sequential comic art, one panel after another, sort of making sense and going through time one moment to the next and carrying an action from one box or panel to the next box or panel. That has become the meaning of comics as is best understood today.
I sometimes wonder if some of those cave paintings, you know, prehistoric cave paintings, weren't really just cartoons.
That's a frequent observation, and I wholly agree with it. I think that the need to express something going on in society, both of a realistic nature, I kill the deer or I want to kill the deer for meat for my family to have, or fantastic nature, I'm pursued by a horrific monster of some superhuman quality. All those things are in the nature of comics, and they must have been from the very time the tale was first told in visual form.
I'm curious what draws you to comics. I'm speaking as someone who's not a big comic fan, but what is it? You know, you've written this book, Comics in Wisconsin. I assume you're an avid comics fan.
Well, it certainly begins when I'm about 5 years old in 1949 because my two sisters, 4 years older than me in the middle of Illinois, were determined to start their little brother reading. Literate of some kind before I got to first grade. So they picked the most natural form of literature available, which was, of course, comic books. That's how I started out with comic books. And for me and for other people my age, before television really took much more of a hold on young people, comic books were the books that we owned. They're the first books we ever owned. They're the only books, sometimes for much of the rest of our lives, that we read more than once. And in the middle 1950s, when I'm maybe 11 years old, the appearance of Mad Comics had a hugely iconic influence on me and so many others in my generation, because they deconstructed or explained all the things that were going on in advertising and television, sometimes even politics, by making fun of them.
Yeah, it was great satire.
They were the kind of message of a very sophisticated nature, so much so that my boyhood idol after Willie Mays was Harvey Kurtzman, the creator of Mad Comics. And later I did a biography of him, very happy to say. They explained things so much to us that they prepared us for the 1960s. And because the comics that were around Harvey Kurtzman that he helped work on, EC Comics, various kinds of anti-war, war comics and so forth, when they were suppressed in the middle 1950s, in the middle of a drive to take dangerous reading matter away from young people, that was sort of a fearful moment in our 1950s when we knew nothing else about political stuff. And then the big leap in the later 1960s of a new, completely unregulated comic type, comic art type, comes partly to recover what had been lost since our childhood. So, you know, I could go on and on, but in the deepest sense, comics have been inside people like myself all of our lives, and I'm just fortunate enough to have been able to come back to it as a critic, sometimes as a very small-scale publisher, and then later on as an editor of a series of comics of nonfiction treating various aspects of American history.
Seems that the first, historically speaking, impression many of us would have about comics would be what might be called the editorial cartoons, whether it's in something like Punch in 19th century England or in this country where he has some really fantastic caricatures of major political figures.
Sure, sure. Absolutely. And sometimes highly influential in bringing down political bosses and so forth. Well, for artists from the 1890s, when the comic strip really emerges, through the 1940s at least, there was no great barrier between doing a daily political cartoon and doing a comic strip in the daily and Sunday papers. Dozens of artists doubled in both of those. One of the most famous is Rube Goldberg, whose name is defined in the Oxford English Dictionary as a Rube Goldberg being a crazy invention that doesn't work. But he got a Pulitzer Prize at the end of the 1940s for strips that were about the artist. Political cartoons that were about the dangers of atomic war.
You write in the introduction to your book that too little is known about the contributions Wisconsin made to the development of comic art. Can you take us to those sort of early beginnings in Wisconsin of people who did contribute to comics?
Sure. I mean, the interesting thing about the comics industry as a comic book industry, it's about greater New York all the way to Connecticut and not much further. And there's only one big break in that history, and it's mostly the Bay Area, San Francisco, Oakland, Berkeley, in the 1970s and 1980s. Most of the rest of it has been centered in New York. But various other comic phenomena of lesser importance have existed here and there. And among the most important are artists who came from the Midwest and other places. In those days, in the 1910s and 1920s, when the daily newspaper strip was the greatest thing that anybody had seen for telling stories, the introduction of the daily story that people would be fascinated and attached to, however dull it seems to many people, me included, when we look back at these things. So you would get boys, always boys, coming off the farms in Wisconsin and Illinois, for instance, and going to Chicago, where they got a job at the Chicago Tribune, one of the real founts of artistic invention in the comics pages, however politically conservative it was, who hit the big time. The two biggies really are Sidney Smith, who lived in Lake Geneva, though he was born and raised in Illinois, and who did a strip called The Gumps, which is regarded as the very first strip to achieve continuity that is a day-to-day continuous story. And it's sort of silly, and it's not brilliantly drawn, but people liked it a lot, and it lasted in his work until the early 1930s when he died suddenly in an automobile accident. And the second person who's a lot more important within the world of art comic history is a guy named Frank O. King from Toma. If you go to Toma today, you'll see banners on the main street of town that say, Toma, home of Frank O. King and Gasoline Alley. They look a little faded now, those banners. They must have been put up a while ago. But his strip, Gasoline Alley, which began in Chicago around 1920 and moved from a story about people, men, working in this repair shop for automobiles, which was a big sensation, new at that point, to an extended family story. A family got bigger and bigger and more extended and lasted 40 or 50 years in his hands into the 1950s and then in the other hands later on. And if there's one strip with which readers and historians identify daily continuity with, it probably is Gasoline Alley.
It's interesting how many of those early strips made the transition to radio.
Well, that's right.
Including Gasoline Alley.
And also the Gumps.
Yes.
Because and to some of the other strips, I'm forgetting now, either became short feature films or even sort of gag-like full-length films, not very successfully. I'm thinking there was a series of low-budget Joe Palooka films and a number of other things taken from the strips and all kinds of other buttons at election time and little flags and so forth and so forth. Makes you realize how deep the fascination of the public was with these artists and their strips that appear daily.
And what about the relationship between the pictures and the words, which, like, if you look at something like the Gumps or Gasoline Alley, which was more important?
Well, I think you have to go back and think about who the audience is. When comics, something like modern comics, was created in the early 19th century, especially by a guy in Switzerland named Rudolf Töpfer. Like the drawings, caricatures that appeared at the time of the American Revolution, these are very obviously small print runs, they had an enormous number of words. They were sort of like political messages or moral messages or ethical messages delivered on the printed page. When they were reinvented after the passage of time in the 1890s, they were invented for the person that read the daily newspaper in the United States, which meant someone who was likely to be semi-literate at best. Either someone from another country to whom the English language was a second language, or someone from the farm who hadn't had that much of an education. So consequently, the sentences are very short. The words are very simple to understand, and one way to think about this is like silent films. There were words in silent films, but there weren't very many words in silent films. And again, it was the action on the screen, the action in the printed comic that appealed to the ordinary reader. And until these continuity guys, they would always have a gag in the last panel. Somebody would fall over and their feet would go up in the air. Mutt and Jeff was famous for doing that. But a lot of other strips were of that nature and often very charming. But just the idea of having continuity and maybe having more words was intended to reach a more middle-class audience. That was the intent of the Chicago Tribune. And I think that the words became somewhat more important. But in truth, the strongest thing about the comics, I'm thinking about Frank O. King and his drawings about himself and his son out in the woods, which may have been Glencoe, Illinois, or it may have been the Kickapoo Valley. You look at the art, and the art is a lot more interesting than what people had to say.
Serious strips at this point, or is it all really lighthearted?
Oh, you know, there's a sense in which Gasoline Alley is serious. People have sort of family problems of one kind or another, and maybe no more serious than a soap opera. Blondie begins as a flapper working in an office and looking for a man to marry. But the serious stuff, if you can call it serious, happens in a rather grotesque way from my point of view in adventures in what we came to call the third world. That is to say, someone is a white man is in Africa or Latin America or someplace and they have to do something very a lot of drama. They have to punch somebody in the jaw. Sometimes they meet an enchantress, a woman who, though her skin is yellow, appeals enormously or because so, et cetera, et cetera. All sort of in the Tarzan vein.
Terry and the Pirates.
Terry and the Pirates is the very best example I can think of. And seen from our later standpoint, these sort of give us the willies because they assume the world is one big place for white men,
yeah.
very few white women to romp around in and have adventures and never get actually killed. But push around all the natives and then attract the ones who are willing to be supine. You know, and if you went on to Dick Tracy and so forth, it's much of the same nature. Criminals are people who look weird, and then by the late 1930s and 1940s, they could be spies, Germans and Russians and so forth. But it's all very black and white, morally, even when it's in color. Really, with some exception, until EC Comics appear in the early 1950s or from another angle, Funny Animal Comics, which had a whole lot of wonderful things in them almost from the beginning and escaped that kind of moral conflation of everything into somebody's right, somebody's wrong, and so forth and so forth. And one supposes were intended especially to appeal to young children. But I know I found them enormously appealing, especially Donald Duck, as I began to grow up. And then Pogo, which is one of the best, most socially concerned
yes.
strips of the 1950s, it still stands up brilliantly. And other things, you know, it's often said that humor and horror are the places that are least censored in American popular culture because nobody is looking for political messages.
Makes me wonder a little bit about Lil Abner, for example. Talk about political commentary.
That, it was said in the 30s, you know, Al Capp ended as an ardent Republican and was arrested in campuses for assaulting co-eds. But way back before then, he was regarded as an ardent New Dealer. And he loved to make fun of very rich and parasitic characters and to sort of, in his own way, him as a Jewish guy from Brooklyn and New Haven, to make fun of these hicks in the imaginary American Ozarks, but to do so in a way that sort of had a social edge.
And could you make a good living as a comic writer? And how would you be regarded if you were someone who devoted your life to creating these comics?
Someone who was an editor, a cultural editor and writer of the Capital Times in Madison once said to me, poets in Madison are always talking about money because they don't have any. And likewise, comics, there were a couple of dozen artists who made pretty fabulous salaries for their time. And I could almost name that dozen very easily because it would or could obscure the fact that there were several hundred others who made it absolutely terrible income scarcely enough to put food on the table. And along with them, since those people were actually getting syndicated, almost all of them, newspaper syndicates owned their work, you got the artists for comic books who worked in sweatshops, really tenement-type places in various parts of New York for a very, very small amount of money, live very badly and fantasize going into advertising because those people actually made money and could buy homes.
Did any of them become animators for films?
You know, that's another interesting point. There was a sort of continuity between doing comics on the printed page and doing animation. The problem was that apart from Terry Toons in a little above New York City, everything else in animation was done in Hollywood. So it was a giant commitment for someone, a young person with comic talent, to move to Los Angeles and look for a job. In general, they were a different sort of people. They were very, very disproportionately Jewish. And it's interesting that the comic strips were probably the least Jewish of any popular culture creation in the U.S.,
True.
Apart from boxing and so forth. They were sort of Midwestern or other Yankee boys and others. And then again, comic books. There never has been an industry that had more Jewish hard workers and Jewish bosses.
Any thought about why it seems, at least from what you're saying, that the productions are mostly male? And I'm guessing the readership largely male as well.
Well, the inclination towards creating the daily comic strip with continuity was not only to gain a more middle-class audience, it was to gain a more family, which is to say wife and children audience. And it seems to have been successful in doing that, although certain kinds of strips like Blondie and others we could think of, Winnie Winkle is one of the rare ones that's actually drawn by a woman. That's highly unusual. Did have a considerable appeal within the comic book industry. There was a minor side of it, of comics produced for teenage girls. And you could say the whole Archie phenomenon.
Right, exactly what I was thinking.
Pretty much right. There, and has been one of the most popular and one of the most banal. but there were a whole bunch of ones in which young female readers could do cutouts and create paper dolls and so forth. But those were a fairly small, no more than 15% part of the market. And superheroes, always very big, were almost always wildly disproportionately male readers, probably 10 to 1 or 20 to 1. Why so? Because they were about boys as readers fantasizing becoming big and muscular and socking people in the jaw.
Charles Atlas, here we come.
Yeah, pretty much so. And it's very interesting to think of the Wonder Woman type comics, Wonder Woman herself, Sheena of the Jungle, and about half dozen other I could name. They featured scantily clad women or women with very, very tight clothes, women with physiques that were a great deal like Barbie. It's how you become a superhero, unlike Lois Lane, who doesn't look like Barbie, and very likely were an early source of sexual interest for young boys. It's sometimes said that in European culture, the male is assumed to be looking around for a female to educate her to sexuality, whereas in American culture, the weakened American male is eagerly hoping some sexually advanced female with great powers will come and discover him and do things to him. And it's a terrible thought, but I think maybe I did think that about Wonder Woman when I was 9 years old.
Would that be true? Let's see. How would you put that spin on something like Little Orphan Annie?
I guess you wouldn't be able to put that spin.
Although it's an adventure story to a great extent.
It is. And when Mad Comics did a satire, it turned out that Daddy Warbucks was her big daddy and that she had a sexy outfit she was keeping in the closet. The hint was always there.
Did he have eyeballs for her too?
That was one of the gags in the strip. So one of the huge objections in the days when Dr. Frederick Wertham was telling Congress that comics were corrupting young people and an occasional burning of comics took place in Wisconsin was that the sweaters were too tight. Another complaint was that Batman and Robin were actually homosexual. So, and mainly that there was juvenile delinquency, and somebody must be to blame for that juvenile delinquency, so it probably was comic books.
And something as innocent as Beetle Bailey, I read once upon a time, it has this voluptuous secretary, Miss Buxley.
Buxley.
And right. Every now and then she would appear, Mort Walker would draw her with a little dot where her belly button should be.
Right.
And the censors would always cut it out with a razor blade and put it in a jar. And they actually had Beetle Bailey's belly button jar.
Well, I think that, again, prompts the notion of why underground comics from the end of the 60s until about 1980 when their market collapses were so revolutionary, not only for men, young male artists drawing all the sexual stuff, but also for women's comics, which were also aggressively, overtly sexual and pretty darn astonishing. The strip that came from a little town outside Los Angeles was called Tits and Clits, and it was just gags. It was all gags. And it was very, very funny, but something that is so far from the possibility of the comic book or the newspaper comic strip that it showed how important it was to be able to express things that heretofore could not be expressed.
First Amendment. It's
First Amendment.
There for you and for me and
Right.
some of those cartoonists. Well, let's look more closely at those underground comics.
Yeah.
When we return in a moment, this is University of the Air.
Songs for the anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination, the death of Robin Hood, and new releases are featured on tonight's Simply Folk. A battle of the bands, too, with traditional songs in contemporary settings. I'm Tom Martin Erickson. Join me tonight at 5 for Simply Folk.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Paul Buell, and we're looking at comics in Wisconsin and comics as a general phenomenon in this country. The underground comics that you just mentioned, Paul, what was it that sparked that? Was it politics or was it this more sexual content?
Well, the first of the underground newspapers of note is The Rag from Austin, Texas. And in a way, it sets the model for the hundreds, literally hundreds of underground newspapers to come. It comes out of a so-called youth culture ghetto not far from a major campus. The people who snap it up for 15 cents a copy, I was one of the salesmen of that kind of newspaper in Madison in those days, lives not too far from campus, has been known to smoke marijuana, believes that young men and women should live together before they get married and maybe not get married at all, and also most emphatically is opposed to the war in Vietnam and has adopted Make Love, Not War as their favorite slogan.
So it's a counterculture.
It is a counterculture, yeah. And in those days very much a youth counterculture.
And how do comics fit in?
Well, two things happened toward the end of the 60s. One is that these newspapers began to look for art that would be interesting to its readers. And young artists, some of them trained in art schools, some of them not trained in art schools, began thinking about reinventing the comic strip. The second thing that happened is these rock posters in San Francisco for the big concerts, the big rock concerts then, offered a way for a few artists to actually make some money because audiences or people looking at posters just love a new kind of comic strip or a new kind of comic art. These things come together when three or four companies are set up within 5 years, all of them in the San Francisco area, and they learn that by publishing these roughly 40-page comics and selling them for 50 cents, they can sell 10,000, 20,000, 50,000, or in the case of comics by Robert Crumb, the leading artist, 250,000. So they appear as a phenomenon. Nothing like them had ever been seen in comic books before. And frequently they're sold in what are called head shops, including one on Gilman Street in Madison called The Electric Eye, in which most of the material was set up for people to smoke marijuana. Nothing more dangerous than that, but it's where you acquired bongs and other such things as that. Well, over in the corner, along with the bongs and the incense and some jewelry made by someone in town, were assorted underground comics.
And what would be the censorship at all? I mean, were these looked at all and prosecuted?
There were efforts made to prosecute them. Dennis Kitchen, who sort of set up the comic book industry in Wisconsin, was arrested at the Schlitz Circus Parade in 1970 for selling his own comic, which had a cheerfully bare-breasted, very unrealistic but humorous type drawing, and the police got him for that. But really, Lady Chatterley's Lover and all the stuff had happened already, the fights over censorship. And aside from places where all this was sort of new and dangerous, a small campus in the South or something, the police had other things to be more concerned about.
So the underground comics takes primarily the form of a comic book, or are there actually ongoing publications that might have them?
Well, it's an interesting question because if you consider there were several hundred, at least, underground newspapers, and those newspapers frequently had a circulation of 5,000 or 10,000 locally, and those newspapers carried comics of this kind, that may have been as large as the circulation of underground comic books. But since people like myself wouldn't have much access to underground newspapers outside the city in which we lived, the main way we would encompass this in our life is through the appearance of these comic books.
You entitle your chapter about it, Underground in Madison, and then you have in parentheses, and Milwaukee.
Yeah.
Can you say something about Madison and Milwaukee and the particular kinds of underground material?
Sure, sure. Well, Madison was, of course, a huge center of underground or counterculture in the later 1960s. And that fellow with the mustache named Paul Soglin hadn't dropped out of history graduate school yet and assumed his larger importance. But the first underground comic drawing appeared in the underground newspaper Connections in 1967 as a response to the so-called Dow Riot and it was drawn by a fellow named Nick Torkelson, whose grandfather was an official of UW around 1920. Following that, I produced a one-shot called Radical America Comics because I was publishing a magazine about history in Madison for Students for Democratic Society. And several underground newspapers in Madison, there were always lots of competition between several of them, published their own underground comics. One of the better knowns at the time was published by Dennis Kitchen in Milwaukee, but with a Madison edition. And he featured Wisconsin comic artists, probably because they were the cheapest to draw or were hardly paid at all. And he sort of set up his own little comics empire in Milwaukee and then moved it to the small town of Princeton, Wisconsin in the early 1970s. And from there on, it became a central publishing focus for several certain kinds of comics, which is quite important and quite unique. One was real cutting-edge stuff. The first issue of Gay Comics appeared in Princeton, which seems pretty amazing. Comics that were actually giving public information for the State Justice Department. In 1975, he published a consumer comic that I think was given free to all high school students. And second, he published a whole series of older reprints by people who weren't known by young readers of that day, Al Capp, Will Eisner, Harvey Kurtzman, and others, who had sort of fallen behind the shadow of the great comic age of the 1930s to early 1950s and then had been left behind by history. Well, the fact that an ordinary reader anywhere could order these comics about comic history in a way was telling the history of comic art. So that had a really great importance, but also, as I say, comics with a real social and political and cultural cutting edge were coming out of Princeton. And perhaps it's not too surprising that a counterculture figure like Dennis Kitchen, surrounded by the occasional marijuana smoker, came to be regarded as a fine figure of a public businessman in a town like Princeton.
What makes them underground?
Ah, well, this is an interesting question because in 1979 or thereabouts, the police had swept in and shut, not only here but elsewhere, shut most of those so-called head shops. The youth culture people who bought underground comics in 1971 had disappeared into American culture and weren't buying them anymore for a variety of reasons. And the so-called underground comic evolved into the alternative comic. Mm-hmm. Underground was a claim that somehow or other there was a stagnant mainstream corporate culture and that the exciting stuff all had to happen underground. It was a reference, I think, to the underground behind enemy lines during World War II.
Sure.
That's what would come to my mind. And when Mad Comics announced that they were being repressed, they said, henceforth, we'll only be publishing comics underground. So
Mad
this is like 1955.
Announced
it was sort
that
of
they
an
were
announcement
repressed
they were going underground. Yes.
Was that for real?
Because there were hearings. It was
sure,
a, it
the
was,
McCarthy
it was a joke.
Era.
It
yeah.
was a joke.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yeah,
I was going to say, because they certainly kept coming up.
Indeed. But the origin of Mad Comics, Mad Magazine, is they could escape censorship, which was quite severe, by turning their comics into a black and white magazine that no longer had to be approved by the Comics Code in order to be sold at a newsstand.
And what is the Comics Code?
Ah, in the wake of these hearings in Congress, very much parallel to the hearings about the communist influence and somewhat directed toward a Jewish industry as, again, corrupting someone, not quite said openly but always undercover. After these hearings, the industry itself, the comics industry itself, agreed to a comics code in which if a comic bore the stamp of the comics code, then it would not be threatened at the newsstand, as was often the case with other comics. The Legion of Decency, connected with the religious institutions, especially the Catholic Church, used to sort of aggressively go after news dealers who had comics that seemed lurid or in some other way unacceptable. So two comic companies refused to accept the comic code. One was EC, which decided to publish Mad Magazine and abandon all of its other comics. And the other one is Classics Illustrated.
Classics Illustrated. Boy, talk about the other extreme. Yeah.
Well, they were the two that opted out and did not want to be censored in that way and went their own way. And I have to say that as important as EC Comics were to me, Classic Comics were as well.
Classic Comics, I mean, literally would recreate, obviously, in miniature, greatly distilled versions, famous books.
Yeah, one could say, and it was frequently said, that it's pretty silly trying to read Julius Caesar in a 48-page comic. But for me, looking back on it, William Tell, what a great comic that was. And 30 years later, I found the woman who wrote it under a ghost name because she had been blacklisted in New York. She was a high school teacher. And a whole bunch of other – how did I come across Mark Twain? By reading the Classic Comics versions. And in other ways, it was said later that junior high school, middle school students would read those instead of their assignments. I'm sure it's true.
Or instead of their Cliff's Notes, which
yes,
would be too long.
Cliff's Notes were the next, you know, they were for college. Classic Comics were for young people. But speaking for myself, I didn't see it that way. I saw it as a gateway to more serious literature.
With Madison and its anti-war activities, how do you see comics attacking what was going on in Vietnam? Are the ones that stand out in your mind?
Oh, you know, certainly that very first strip by Nick Torkelson, subsequently, and a whole lot of stuff that appeared in Connections, Madison Kaleidoscope, and King Street Trolley, and one or two other so-called underground newspapers. But I must confess, Radical America Comics, that I published one single issue, was loaded with satires about the silliness of war. It wasn't a case of carrying on a propaganda campaign because the readers already had the same sentiments, many of them, but finding a more humorous way to put the issue. Gilbert Shelton, one of the greatest of the underground artists, had a figure called Wonder Warthog, which was obviously a satire on Superman that he'd been drawing. And this particular episode was Smiling Sergeant Death. That is to say, a typical war comic hero is sent on a mission that's completely insane to invade China and do something, and is about to be captured or killed, and then Wonder Warthog comes and saves him, you know, that kind of thing. So it was a way of satirizing but finding a different angle of view so you weren't holding up a picket sign.
How are the mainstream comics changing at this point as we get into the mid-60s?
Well, the strange thing is that mainstream comics enjoyed a revival. Marvel and DC, the two companies that still dominate the now badly diminished field of actual comics in their original format. But when they were reinvented, their readerships were mainly on campuses. They were perhaps 10% of what the readership had been in 1945, which was the largest readership of any periodicals in the United States. Comic books were the most popular printed articles in the United States from the wartime until close to 1950. But on the other hand, when they reemerged in Marvel and DC in the middle 1960s, they were the same old war comics, same old patriotic, we can defeat the enemy kind of stuff, with the addition of superheroes that now had some kind of supernatural connection, Thor and so forth. But they had the same problem. That is to say, artists never owned their own characters. Artists were just assigned to those characters. And writers who were different from the artists, who were different from the inkers, writers were stuck to a narrative that never allowed more sophisticated dialogue than whack, pow, exclamation marks, a lot of exclamation marks.
Satirized in the Batman TV show.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. And, you know, many people listening to this broadcast may be very fond of those superhero comics, and that's fine. I don't have any objection. I can only say for myself, the art isn't interesting, and therefore, as a genre, they're not too interesting to me.
Well, talking about art, then which images, would you say, from the comics running through the 60s and 70s, which ones kind of emerge as works of art? The way you have sort of Andy Warhol, taking things in pop culture becomes art.
Well, that's an important parallel because the dominant art in the 1950s was abstract expressionism and it abolished the human figure. The most remarkable thing that happens from the middle 1960s on is the return of the figure or figuration. It happens in women's art. It's very important it happens that way. Andy Warhol actually contributes to the breakdown of abstract expressionism or free enterprise art, as Henry Luce used to call it. But underground comics also have their role. And I don't have much doubt in saying that Robert Crumb is the most famous. He has a book on the bestseller list right now called Genesis, a literal rendition of the book of Genesis, which is really a remarkable book.
By literal, you mean graphic?
It's a literal graphic with as little left out as possible.
Yeah,
there's nothing. There's no satirical element to it.
I saw that that was reviewed in the New York Times.
Indeed.
Yes.
Indeed. And he's trying to show what comic art can do or what his comic art can do, and leaving behind all humor and so forth and so forth. So he's a very, very great figure. I just mentioned Gilbert Shelton. He has his protagonist, the fabulous furry freak brothers, who really smoke a lot of dope and get away with a lot of things and were enormously beloved by the counterculture. And others of that sort of rebellious ilk. But you can also look to artists like Trina Robbins, who's the major figure in the creation of women's underground comics. And then as you move into the 70s and 80s, we see the work of people such as Alison Bechdel, who eventually will do Fun Home, one of the most heralded books. And you'll see work by a number of other artists, but most of all, a book that will eventually become a Mouse, M-A-U-S, by Art Spiegelman, which by the mid-90s is featured in the Museum of Modern Art, his original drawings, wins a Pulitzer Prize, and probably establishes comic art as art with a capital A more than any other single force. He was a worker in the fields of underground comics living in San Francisco with everybody else. And a few other people who managed to make it into something like the mainstream, Bill Griffith, who does Zippy the Pinhead in a lot of daily newspapers, comes straight out of that milieu.
Let's look at some more of the examples of comics as art and history when we return in a moment. This is University of the Year.
We want to know what you think, and we'd like to answer your questions about WPR. Our audience services staff can help you on the phone and online. Call 800-747-7444 or click on Listener Feedback at WPR.org.
In 1970, after art school in New York City, I landed in Madison, thinking it would be like living on Pluto. Instead, I discovered the Athens of the Midwest. All hip radicals passing between California and New York stopped off to exchange cultural DNA. From pre-World War I Hearst newspaper strips to contemporary art comics, Paul Buell uncovers the development of Wisconsin as a center of creative and radical cartooning. That's from a review by Sharon Rudall of the book Comics in Wisconsin by our guest, Paul Buell. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and we're talking about comics in Wisconsin. I wanted to mention, too, that we do have some of the images that we've been talking about linked to on our website. So if you follow the University of the Air website on WPR.org, you'll see some of the pictures of comic strips that we've been talking about. With your discussion of comics in Wisconsin, what kind of developments do you see more recently that excite you?
Well, out in Mount Horeb, not so far from Madison, a guy named Tom Pomblin has been publishing Graphic Classics, a sort of new version of Classics Illustrated for the last few years, and publishing an awful lot of very nice stuff. But I myself have returned to what I regard as a La Follette-esque impulse of telling truth historically and finding a way to offer it to young audiences. Overwhelmingly, the people who read comic art books are under the age of 25. And judging from my own students at Brown University over the last 10 years, ordinary students read fewer and fewer books with each passing year. So the importance of finding a way to reach young people, even if it is like my comic art book with Harvey Pekar called The Beats, trying to get those young people to go ahead and read the novels or poetry or whatever, which are hinted at and the artist's life is described and so forth. This is an important part of public education today, certainly to me. And another great example is an adaptation of Howard Zinn's totemic People's History of the United States. Mike Konopacki, the artist for the Capital Times and State Journal, did this adaptation. He did the art, and a fellow named Dave Wagner, who was a newspaper person in Madison in the 1970s, did most of the script. So it was an attempt to take this Howard Zinn book and make it into a kind of explanation of what is U.S. foreign policy, what does it mean, and so on. But another example would be Studs Terkel's working a graphic adaptation. Being an oral history teacher, I always regarded Studs Terkel as a god of our field and as a wonderful humane influence in American culture. So when I got the opportunity to do an adaptation with a number of artists of Studs Terkel's most famous book, Working, I leaped at it. That's the kind of thing, nonfiction and about U.S. history, that I find most compelling in comic art. That's my little corner of it. If I have a chance to produce a book, especially for young women, like a biography of Isadora Duncan, the famous inventor of modern dance, or of Emma Goldman, one of the first activists for birth control, a famous anarchist, then I grab that opportunity because I think that young people will see through comic art what they wouldn't find in the printed page otherwise.
It makes me wonder what the average age of a reader of the comics pages in a newspaper is, because newspapers seem to be trying harder and harder to skew younger with their audience. And if they can't do it there, where can they do it?
I think that the daily newspapers, by and large, the majority of them are doomed. They may be able to go online and survive or not. If they do survive, it'll be with smaller audiences and much, much smaller staffs. And I have the sense that the effort to attract a younger audience through the comic pages is more or less dead in advance. The comic pages remain so familiar to me as if I saw those strips when I was 12 years old in Illinois, and they haven't gotten any more interesting. Imagine Snuffy Smith.
Yeah.
who would identify with Snuffy
Smith
now?
Yeah, Rex Morgan.
You know, Rex Morgan. Yeah, it's another good example. These things seem like they've been preserved in amber. They're part of some distant American popular culture that doesn't even make sense anymore.
I'm curious about the process you use. Let's say you're going to be creating a comic about Emma Goldman and her life. How do you decide what to put in the balloon? I mean, obviously, you're not going to do the Zao pop.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is a problem which can only be solved by the artist himself, in that case, herself. And it involves putting action together with words, what we call breakdown. That is, the text in this case would be Emma Goldman's memoirs and two or three biographies of her. Finding incidents, all about telling stories. So finding incidents within her life that are the most revealing, her background as a child, her trials and tribulations in the streets of New York, her disillusionment in Russian communism and so forth, selecting very specific stories which encapsulate the sensibility of her life and delivering those stories in art that is somewhat realistic but also interesting as a form of comic art, related to what comic art has been historically, but trying to push it in a somewhat different direction.
How does the internet affect comic art as a medium?
Well, that's a great question, because over 90%, maybe 95% of all comic art now appears on the internet, with a little 5% appearing in print. And the reason for that is young people in particular can publish, in quotes, their comic art without getting it published in printed form. So naturally. But it's hard to get a larger picture of comic art on the internet, because the best way is to go to the homepage of the particular artist. It's their way of selling their work and getting people to know about them. But it doesn't offer you a very good overall picture. And maybe one way that that's found is through the various websites that are focused on comic art. There are now quite a few of them. And probably too many, and many of those are focused on the same old superhero comics. So there really isn't any way to get a very much of a grip. Many people go to these comic cons, which are now large enough to fill football stadiums in San Diego every August. But the field is chaotic and boom and bust, as it's always been in the world of comics. And no one quite knows what comic art is. And from the viewpoint of the New York Times, the most important thing is that comic art is being sold to Hollywood and making hundreds of millions of dollars, mostly superhero adaptations. So that makes comic art more interesting in itself. cultural reviewers always read the business pages.
You use the term comics with an X sometimes in your book. What do you mean by comics spelled that way?
When artists in the 1960s, 1970s wanted it to show that they were doing something entirely different, including totally uncensored, they invented this word with an X. When they left that behind and those who could still make a living went into alternative comics, the niche market, they got rid of the X and went right back to C and S, where it remains today. Another little thing frozen in time.
Now, I assume that computer technology also makes it possible for people to generate the comic art without as much
That's very
craft.
True. Every artist I know over 60 draws all the dialogue by hand. No artist under 30 draws all the dialogue by hand or any of it by hand. Likewise, the collage has been reinvented through Photoshop. And collage, cartoon collage art is very interesting. It's just not familiar to me. But I can see it emerging as a new kind of art form and so forth and so forth. It's obvious that all kinds of art now are possible and with the speed that's possible. And it isn't very much like the old fellow working over the on a Bristol board over a drawing board. But it isn't entirely unlike that either, because the artist always faces the same questions. How do I create art? Do I have any creative control over my art? Always a big question. And third, can I make a living out of it?
So will Superman ever go public domain?
Doesn't seem so with its long legal history. Superman's publisher killed Captain Marvel, which I always regarded as one of the cruelest blows within comics.
Competition.
Yeah. I think that new kinds of comic art are going to be invented which continue to break down all the categories and which at least part of show a very serious literary and aesthetic eye and do some very striking things in the next 10 years and longer. And we've only begun to see just how remarkable they are.
Do you see some global developments now that with the internet you've got people reading and looking at things from all different countries simultaneously?
Sure. I happened to edit a biography of Che Guevara, and it was adapted to 9 languages besides English and Malaysia, Japan, South Korea, Greece, and so forth. We don't yet have enough circulation of art coming back our way. We don't yet know how exciting the new comic art is from Africa, for instance, although the classics of European comic art from the 30s to the 40s are becoming better known now than they were before. So we're just at the beginning of the process of a global circulation of comic art, and that's another aspect of one of the most exciting developments.
Paul Buell has been our guest this hour, and quite the romp it has been through the comics, whether it's CS or X or the funny pages or however you want to define it. You have a pretty good idea of what you see from day to day, and now maybe a little better idea of some of what's behind it. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, both of you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.